We have a breed of a species of monkey in Barbados called the green monkey. They're not native, and now they have basically become a plague on the island.
So the monkeys read this verse in the Bible and they saw, be fruitful, multiply, have dominion.
There you go. They're like, hold my beer.
Yeah,
I'll show you dominion.
exactly. It's just theological monkeys. And we are just eating everything. All the mangoes and everything. Welcome to episode 288 of Pup Theology Live, a weekly conversation on life and faith over a craft brew pint, a fine wine, or whatever happens to be in your glass. On today's episode, no Shannon, so it'll be Reverend Ogun Holder and myself, Reverend Brian Burkhoff, and we'll address and engage what's happening through a theological lens with a good brew, or some kind of beverage at least, in hand.
And that good brew might be in your very own Pub Theology Live pint glass, which you can get, well, supply glass, when you become a sponsor on Patreon. Get some pre and post show banter, extra conversation, and really you're supporting the show. Help us cover administrative costs to keep this coming to you scot-free. And now when you head over to Patreon, you can get some previews of our discussions to really see if you want to sign up or not. Ignore the previews, just sign up anyways. Patreon.com/PT Live. Always thank you to our current sponsors. And we might meet some of those sponsors when we are at the Goose, Wild Goose. We will be there at the Goose Cast recording live yet again, putting the live in Pub Theology Live, July 11th to 14th. Van Hoy Farms in Union Grove, North Carolina. Travel with your fans and your portable AC units if you have them. It will be sweltering, but it's going to be fun, and you can get a discount if you haven't bought your ticket yet if you use the code A-SW24. That's A-SW24. You will get $50 off the price of an adult weekend ticket. That's our special Pub Theology Live code. Once again, A-SW24, and hope to see you there. Come on down to the Goose. Today, we're going to discuss taxes, Earth Day, and more. I look forward to seeing what that more is myself. I've been gone for a little bit. We had 2 weeks off. I wasn't here last week. I'm a little rusty, but let's start with what we are drinking. What are you drinking, Brian? What do you got?
Yeah. So we are recording. It's morning where I am. Not where Ogun is, but where I am. So in lieu of a beer, I am drinking a little beverage I concocted, which is a little turmeric, a little ginger, and a little honey. So sort of like there's no tea in it, but it becomes a kind of a nice little beverage. So just a hot drink.
Yeah. Could have put a little shot of, like, you know, Irish whiskey or like brandy in there, just to.
I could have put a little whiskey in it. Put some salt, you know.
This whole thing about like, you know, can't drink alcohol before noon. I find it interesting. Interesting, but we'll go to brunch at 11 and drink mimosas. But I mean, neither here nor there.
Fair, very fair. What do you got, Ogun?
So for a long time, I would say to people, I am not a gin drinker. Don't like gin. I not clear. Not don't like vodkas. I was not a big fan of the clear liquors. You know, I'm doing rum, whiskey, that sort of deal. I'm here in Casablanca, Morocco, again, as I am a couple times a year. Before I came here, I stopped in London to visit a longtime high school friend of mine. And what she said to me is, you would like gin, it's just that you've been drinking shitty gin. And she popped open her liquor cabinet and introduced me to this baby. This is a Japanese craft gin called Roku Gin. And she made me a basic gin and tonic. Gin, tonic water, and just a dash of Angostura bitters. I am now a gin drinker.
Nice.
This is some good stuff right here.
There you go. Yes. And the side benefit to Roku gin is, you know, your favorite shows just sort of pop up in your mind as you're drinking it.
You definitely do some streaming in your mind when you drink this up. So and gin apparently is a very deceptively intoxicating drink. You don't really feel it. At least for me, I don't really feel like I'm drinking it until it's too late.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, I've done a couple of G&Ts and suddenly you're like, wait, what's happening?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I'm now a gin fan, apparently. Good. It's got to be good gin. So now good I went down a rabbit hole to do some gin research. But yes, Roku nice. Gin. All right.
I tend to go with the Bombay Sapphire gin, which comes in the blue glass bottle. Mm-hmm. That's the one I tend to go to, but I haven't experimented with a lot of other kinds, so I'm kind of intrigued.
Next week, I have another Japanese drink that I, it was a Japanese whiskey. I'll introduce that next week. But that was good too. So, all right. I apologize to all you gin drinkers out there who I've maligned over the years. I take it back. Gin is good.
There you go. Apology accepted. We were in Chicago for a little bit over spring break with the kids, and we went to Trader Joe's. And unlike other Trader Joe's I've been to, they had whiskey, they had scotch, they had gin, and some pretty nice prices. So I bought a single malt scotch
nice
for under $20. That was
was
crazy. Depending. Like single malt is usually at least 40, 50, and up.
Yes, depending on the state you're in, Trader Joe's does have some really good alcohol and prices too. Although now I'm a bit mad with Trader Joe's because they seem to be on this anti-union bent recently. And not a fan.
I got you. On to today's topics. All right. So it was recently April 15, which is tax day. So our question is, our opening question, share a tax experience that stands out in your mind, good or bad. If there are good ones, I'm not sure.
No, I usually have good ones. I think in all the years I've been paying taxes, there was maybe only one or two I end up owing. I love it when like I owe for state, but then the federal refund cancels that out and I'm good. One year I got close to $4,000 back and I would have been very excited except for the fact that I had owed them some taxes on the sale of a house from the year before. So I ended up really not seeing any of that $4,000.
They always find a way.
They always find a way. I think though, here's what I'm proposing. Like, you know, I don't, because I'm over here in Casablanca and I did not remember to bring all of my tax stuff with me. I usually travel with all my things so that I can file taxes, you know, when I'm traveling. And I forgot. So I'm going to, you know, did the extension, going to wait till I get back to the States, get all my stuff together.
Yeah.
And not, unfortunately, not all of it is digital. So I do have to wait till I get back. But you know, when I think of how much money the US is spending generally on military and now specifically in, you know, the bombs killing people in Gaza, I'm like, you know, can I become a conscientious tax objector and not contribute to that? Or at the very least, I think we should be able to earmark where our taxes go. You know, like check a box, military spending, infrastructure, education.
100%.
Like, can we do that? I don't know if there's another country that does that. Maybe there is. Show us how. But like, you know, we can check our boxes. So the people who like to, like things to be blown up by American missiles, sure, let your taxes go for that. Me, I want to pay for schools and good roads. Let me put my taxes towards that.
I am with you. I am 100% with you. Like on the grounds of, you know, going to support infrastructure, education, you know, the public good, great. Happy to pay those taxes. Well, happy-ish. But the ones that are literally used to kill people, Yeah. I feel sick about that. And there's no like differentiating. And I guess maybe I don't feel sick enough to go to prison over it, but because I'm still paying my taxes, but man, it's not good.
Right. And let's be clear, the whole going to prison thing is like, there's a whole lot of steps between that happening. Right. So it's not,
probably right.
It's not like, you know, you miss a year or two, you know, they'll send you a bill. They will maybe, if you don't pay, send that to collection agency. You know, there's steps. You're not going to pull a Wesley Snipes here and suddenly you're in jail.
They're not going to. So the IRS is not showing up on April 16 when you didn't pay on the 15th, ready to haul you.
Exactly. Exactly. They're not going to do what, you know, remember we had a minute where the conservative, think machine was like, oh, you know, all this money Biden wants to send to the IRS to arm the IRS folks who are going to come and kick your door down. And no, none of that. That's not how any of that works at all. And by the way, can we finally get the billionaires paying some taxes? I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Just saying. Exactly.
Rig for the rich folk. So what about this, you? What's your tax history?
Yeah. Or, so 2 years ago, we overpaid. And because I work for a church and I'm a clergy member, like taxes are not withheld from my check. So I have to pay quarterly estimates to sort of guess at what my tax liability will be. And I overpaid 2 years ago. So I paid much less this year. So I knew I was going to owe, but I had some kind of tax money set aside knowing I was going to owe. But one nice thing was that we bought an electric car last year. And so we did get a tax credit for that, which helped soften the blow. Nice. I still had to write a sizable check, but it did soften the blow to get the EV tax credit. So I was glad about that.
Nice.
The worst, and this has happened to me more times than I care to say, is when you get an IRS notice like in June or July saying your tax preparer messed up or you messed up and you actually owe $3,000 that you didn't think you owed. Like that has happened to me multiple times. And that is no good. That like I'm on like my third tax person, like in my sort of adult professional life, and it's gone well so far with the new person. But like I've had two prior preparers who screwed up and then one who screwed up and wanted me to pay them for the extra work they had to do to make it right.
Hell no.
And I was like, what? You're billing me for work you created for yourself? Nope.
I feel they should be paying part of the tax that they messed up.
That's what I felt like. I'm like, I owe all this extra money. You told me I didn't owe. I already have to pay that. And now you want me to pay you more?
Yeah, no. No.
That's not happening.
No.
Not happening. Ugh. All right. So
wait.
Yeah,
you got like four kids. You got like four dependents. How are you still owing?
Well, I mean, we got three that are over 18 now, so I think we're losing some of that. And
wait, what? Oh my god, I forgot how old
I say three.
Kids are.
I meant two.
Okay, two. Keep track of your kids, man.
I don't know why I said three. We have two who are 19 or older, and so I'm not sure we're getting the child tax credit we used to.
Was that three a Freudian slip of wishful thinking?
Well, the other one is 17, so he's knocking on the door. And then the one after that is 15. So, you know, in short order, we'll be beyond those tax credits.
All right.
Yeah. So when it comes to taxes, there's a couple of different views, particularly people of faith, or we might even say Christians. Some will say that in terms of following biblical teachings like caring for the poor, welcoming the stranger, protecting the vulnerable, that we should do that on a personal level or congregational level, like private individuals or churches should do that. We'll say that's the private route. Others argue that we should be happy to support federal and local policies at the government level that create a strong social safety net to ensure folks have what they need. And so those folks are happier to pay taxes and have people pay their fair share. The other folks who want to privatize everything say we should push for more tax cuts, I tend to lean toward taxes are proper part of having a stable and strong society. So I can guess, I think, where you land, but what have you heard in the different settings you've been in, congregationally and otherwise?
Well, I mean, I'm always a both and kind of person. So I feel we can do both. But my issue with the tax cuts is tax cuts generally are pushed by one party, and they're generally pushed to one group of people, which are the people who don't need the tax cuts.
Correct.
Right. So, you know, when I mentioned earlier about the billionaires paying taxes, it's like this almost quid pro quo agreement, you know, we'll give the billionaires all these tax breaks, and then they will contribute to our campaigns and our super PACs and stuff like that. And some of these super PACs, I don't know if they're nonprofits or not, but then they become a write-off, and it's a whole thing. So, you know, cut the taxes of the people who need the help financially, like who really need the help.
Yeah.
You know, I forget the representative from Texas who, oh my God, the name's escaping me right now. I was just about to mention her name. She's a Black woman, and she proposed that, you know, when we have this broader conversation around reparations, can we consider like some extra tax cuts to Black folk, especially right. Black folk who need the help, you know? So it's like, yeah. And the first thing as well, the welcome in the stranger, the caring for the poor, the creating the safety nets. Yeah, all that needs to happen too, because that benefits, you know, everyone at certain financial levels, regardless of who they are. And, you know, it still irks me. I was just having this discussion the other day. I was watching a piece, John Oliver, this past Sunday on Last Week Tonight, did a piece about Medicaid. Mm. And I was talking about, you know, my residencies in Maryland, and Maryland has a great Medicaid system. But every year now, it's like, I got to make sure I've not been kicked off. I got to, you know, submit proof of income or lack thereof to show that I am eligible for Medicaid. And, but it just irks me those states that still refuse to expand their Medicaid coverage. It irks me the states that put in work requirements for Medicaid, even though the vast majority, and I mean the vast majority of people on Medicaid are already working. It's like those who need the most help have to do the most to earn that help, which I think is very counterintuitive, very un-Christian. And it just irks me that the party that wants to boast that they are their God's party are the ones that often do the most removing of the safety net for people who need it the most. Like the hypocrisy just goes, you know, unnoticed. And yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. I think that's often the case, right? The tax cuts are pushed, and then it's the folks who don't need it who experience it. And then that leaves the government, you know, sort of hamstrung and having to make budget cuts. And what gets cut is not military spending, which gets more bloated and bloated and idiotically big every year. Instead, it is those social safety programs. And so not only are the people who need the tax cuts not getting them, then they're also losing out on the programs that they depend on, whether that's, you know, SNAP for food assistance or housing assistance or education, you know, helping pay for higher education, et cetera. And it's like, come on, as you said, well, it hurts everyone in our society when we cut off folks from having their basic needs met, because what does that do? It destabilizes the whole place.
Exactly.
It raises crime. It, you know, it makes some parts of towns and cities, they struggle more, right? And then it becomes imbalanced. And it just, like, when we're all, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Like, we can all do well. We have enough resources for everyone to have their basic needs met. Let's do that.
Yeah. 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 But, you know, heaven, and I, you know, it's weird because, so the Republican Party, the ideas that they tend to push are becoming more and more antiquated, right? I mean, look at Arizona, for example, who just kicked in that ridiculous abortion law from the 1800s, and it's all the things. And I feel like they're the ones in a prime position to surprise us with some really popular, if they really want to get back their sense of popularity and people connecting with them, throw down some legislation that will really benefit folks and earn them some money. You know, if you want to be in power this badly, do the things that will get you in power.
Yes, and what frustrates me is what we see more and more is instead of having better policies and pushing better candidates, they keep trying to subvert the voting system. So they disenfranchise voters, they'll redistrict through gerrymandering,
Yeah.
and they'll do all the other things except be freaking good candidates pushing good policies. And it drives me crazy. Like, there's a way to legitimately win. You don't have to game the system.
And it's becoming more and more not just archaic, but misogynist, racist, all the things. Like, there's conversations right now happening around, I forget who the Republican politician is, but it's beginning to gain steam in terms of, he said, if you look back at the last elections, if women weren't voting, they wouldn't have been a Democratic president. So maybe we should take a look at allowing women to vote. And I'm just like, it's like, am I having a fever dream right now? Is the gin too strong? Like, what is happening
Right.
that there are people actually saying this out loud?
Out loud that maybe it was a mistake to let women vote. What?
I mean, it's
What?
like I can't believe it. And the thing is that the rest of us go like, well, that's just stupid and nobody's gonna go for that. And it's like, you know, we kind of said that, but the whole Roe v. Wade thing, and look at where we are now. Like, you know, we go like, yeah, they're not gonna come after same-sex marriage. They're not gonna come after birth control. And like, kind of look at what's happening right now. They're coming after all these things. So when people, was it Maya Angelou who said, you know, when people tell you who they are, believe them. And they keep telling us who they are. And for some reason, we don't want to believe them. Like, believe them, folk. Yeah.
Right, 100%. All right. Well, this past Monday was tax day. The following Monday is Earth Day.
Okay.
So, broad view, what is one environmental issue that concerns you the most right now? There's a lot, but if there were one.
There's a lot. I mean, global warming is the big thing. Like, the use of continual use of fossil fuels, the warming of the oceans and the air, climate change. And, you know, coming from a Caribbean island that is basically at sea level, like, you know, I'm taking notice of beaches I go to over the last few years and beginning to see, a lot of that shore that I used to sit on doesn't exist anymore. And it's like, oh yeah, my favorite spot where the ocean used to lap at my toes is now, and I used to sit in, is now where the ocean always is. So yes, people saying that the rising ocean levels are not a thing we need to worry about, it's a thing we need to worry about. But I read an article this morning that now has me in a new state of despair
Oh
and
no.
panic about the environment.
Oh no.
In the Atlantic, there's a great piece about in Tanzania, the Maasai people are being pushed off their ancestral homelands in the name of, you'll never believe it, conservation. So what's happening right now is there's a lot of rich, rich folk. And we talking like people from Dubai. We talking from people from the United Arab Emirates. We're talking like even places in the, you know, people in the US, some rich folk who are funneling a lot of money into Tanzania to create these like game reserves, right? And the whole point of these game reserves is to leave the land like pristine. And then there's, you know, the local government is like, well, the numbers of Maasai people are exploding, which is true. Their population has like doubled in the last few years. We have to conserve our pristine land. And they do this, and they've done this by forcibly relocating a lot of these people, razing their villages to the ground, and creating these game preserves, which are basically overrun now by tourists and, you know, the Land Rovers coming to see nature. And it's kind of nuts. Mm-hmm. Here's the interesting part, though. The interesting part is the Maasai people are traditionally farmers. They've been, like cattle herders, the cows. They raise cows. Cows were seen as, like, when you own a cow or cows, it's part of how you have become successful.
Sure.
And the way they are in relationship with the land in terms of grazing and moving their herds around to graze in different pastures and letting pastures revitalize themselves, like, it actually not only saves the ecosystem, but helps the ecosystem to thrive. And now in places that they have been forcibly relocated to, now there's too many of them for the land that they've been forced onto. So now the land is becoming deprived and, you know, overranched. And these game preserves, there's all this like wonderful grass and natural stuff growing that's not being used by the cowherders and the Maasai people, who are now being forced into quote unquote civilization in manufactured towns and government housing, and they're being forced to take jobs like security guards and taxi drivers and all these things. And that's not what they want.
Right.
But all in the name of, you know, it's capitalism at its worst, but it's under the guise of conservation. Wow. And I read this piece this morning, and I am like, I was about to cry.
Yep.
Because I was like, this is and then I went into being rageful for a second, because I was like, I'm sorry, the idea that you're doing this under the name of something good is doubly infuriating.
Right.
You know, and yeah, it's insane. It's insane. So that's happening in the world. Sorry to depress everyone.
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to bring some really good news around the environment and nature and conservation. You know, I think
what you said, an issue that concerned me, like, that was inherently not good news.
No, I did. Of course.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Capitalism is killing us. Like, it is just killing us. And we're still leaning into it. And the Tanzanian government is like, you know, yeah, but now we have all these billions and billions of dollars coming into our economy. And I'm like, yeah, but at what cost?
Right.
Like, your greatest currency is your land. I get that. It's your greatest asset. But if you sell it off, and by the way, one of these game reserves is pretty much owned by like some Saudi, like, you know, prince or something. And when the family, the Saudi family, goes there, it's not open to the public. We talking like hundreds of thousands of acres. They're private hunting ground when they're there.
Yeah.
And then when they're not there, you know, people can pay a fee to go drive around. But it's just insane. Why can't we say no to the money?
No doubt. And the irony is, it's so much of that is oil money now pretending
exactly
to care about conservation.
Exactly. And it is just laying waste to the land in other parts. You're displacing like your people.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, no doubt a lot of that money coming in is going in the pockets of government officials, you know, because corruption. And yeah, so.
So there was a woman, I don't know if you saw this, who was on a safari. I don't remember what country. I don't think it was Tanzania, but was on a safari, and they got a little too close to an elephant, and the elephant came at their SUV or their, you know, their safari truck, knocked it over, and this woman ended up being killed by the elephant.
You know,
and I kind of felt like, you know, if you're a Westerner who's got money to go to Africa and go on a safari, and nature says, yeah, no thanks.
I mean,
like, it's tragic, but I was like,
Listen, I don't wish ill on anyone. No. And at the same time, you know, but equal to, so like, but let's have a real conversation around ecotourism, right? That's, so, you know, I come from a country, Barbados, that is, I don't know, pretty much totally reliant on tourism. Yeah. And there are a lot of eco tour outfits there, and it legitimately is the livelihood of a lot of people.
Right.
So I'm not 100%. This is not an anti eco tourism rant that I'm on. But if it's not done responsibly, and remembering who it is really for, then you inadvertently do more harm than good. You know,
yes.
The one thing Barbados has going for it is, compared to some other, like Jamaica does a lot of privatization of beaches, and hotels and resorts come in and displace local people to build these resorts. Some of them end up not being completed. You know, local folks can't go to their beaches. Years back in Barbados, and it still holds true, you can't privatize any beach in Barbados. So even if you build a massive resort, there always has to be beach access for local people. You can't keep local people off the beach.
Nice.
Now, sometimes that beach access is a little hard to find.
Yeah.
But it's there. Yeah. It has to be there.
Yeah.
By law, right? So at least in the, you know, we seem to strike a good balance between, yes, we are reliant on tourism dollars, but this is our country, and we will also prioritize the folks who live here. And yeah, strike a good balance that way. It breaks my heart to see places that don't do that, because you inevitably hurt your people and the environment and those very tourist assets, natural assets that you purport to care about and use as the draw to get money in. So again, it's that both and thing. Where's the middle ground? And I think you always find the middle ground when you prioritize what's most important, which is the people and the place.
Right.
When you prioritize the dollars, you will always do it wrong.
Yeah. Someone or someplace will come up, will get the short end of that when you do that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The King James translation of Genesis 1:28 somewhat famously says, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." Other translations will use conquer for subdue, or rule over for have dominion. So it feels like a classic text that has been used to justify harm to creation for what we were just saying, the sake of profit. And is there a better way to read this text? Is God giving humans license to do whatever you want? Like, subdue it, have dominion. Those feel like very like power-centric words, rather than, I think many of us would prefer, a more living in harmony sort of approach with the land. But we've taken it as, hey, it's here and we can do what we want with it. How do we do better?
Well, I think you have to start remembering that we are not separate from the earth, right? And this text kind of puts us in this position of, we are better than, we have power over, we are more evolved than, the rest of the planet than the animals. And we're not, we are part of it. So for me, dominion, I read as stewardship, and stewardship for me means, you know, responsibility and accountability to take care of a thing so that we all benefit and thrive, us the caretakers and whatever we're taking care of. And to remember that we're not separate from it. But I think we see ourselves, humanity, we see ourselves, some of us do, as we're better than, we're smarter than, therefore we know what's best. It's like paternalism. And I think when you look, the lesson we still have not learned from Indigenous peoples is, if anything Indigenous peoples have and continue to have right, is that we are part of it all, and we are in relationship with it all, as opposed to we are power over it all.
Yeah, for sure. I've seen other translations that will say, you are my caretakers. You know, that's more of a loose translation, but I think gets to that idea of stewardship. You know, God is entrusting us as stewards, as caretakers. And that's a totally different framing, right?
To
take care of something means to help it thrive. Not like,
yes,
beat the hell out of it so that I can make a dollar and build a big mansion, and no matter what cost to the local habitat or natural environment. But we've taken it to justify all of the expansive growth of industrialism and capitalism. And you wonder, when have we crossed the point of no return? Like, maybe we're way past it. You know, like I live in a pretty rural area. We've got some beautiful areas. But there's a lot of roads and cars, and I see roadkill all the time. And I think, where did these animals have to go where this nice piece of earth that isn't bisected by all these roads and there's cars? And what if you got to get from here to there and you got to cross the street to get there? Like, it's just kind of heartbreaking. Like, you don't just have the acres and acres and acres in too many places now. There are some, of course, on this earth, thank goodness, but there's too many places where there's just so darn many of us humans, and we're getting around from here to there with our cars or with what have you, and it's just not good for the environment, the animals, any of it.
Now, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I'm about to offer a counterpoint here.
Yeah.
counterpoint to my own argument. And I think I mentioned this before when I was in Barbados and we were recording. I mentioned the green monkeys in Barbados. I don't remember if I did or not, but we have a breed of a species of monkey in Barbados called the green monkey. They're not native to Barbados. They were brought over way back in the time when we were also bringing in, you know, enslaved African peoples. So they're originated from Africa, Central Africa. And now they have basically become a plague on the island. And when I say a plague, what I mean is they will eat everything. So we have farmers who are losing anywhere from 50 to 80% of their crops because of these monkeys. There are two mango trees growing outside my grandmother's house that we have not eaten the fruit from in like years, because these monkeys will, like, you know, as soon as the mangoes start coming out, they'll go and start eating them. And if they're not ripe and ready, they'll take two bites, go like, this is gross, and throw them on the ground.
Oh my
and gosh. So we it's insane. There are farmers who have had to shift their entire crop, what they grow, so that the monkeys, you know, we know monkeys won't eat these foods, so we're going to grow these, which, when you think about it, means it's affecting what we eat. So the monkeys are changing the whole like agricultural ecosystem of the island.
Yeah.
The farmers aren't happy about it. The people who are mostly on the side of the monkeys are, again, conservationists who don't even live on the island.
Wow.
Right. They're like, don't harm the cute monkeys. And by God, they are cute. Don't harm the cute monkeys. because that's not quote unquote good for the environment. But these things are wreaking havoc.
They're wreaking havoc. And as Peter Gabriel said, sometimes you have to shock the monkey.
Sometimes. I don't know that song, but good for you.
Yeah, hey, check it out. A little old, earlier Peter Gabriel. But okay. I don't think what you're saying is a counterpoint, because it was a non-native species, right? Introduced by humans to a place where they didn't belong. Yes. And it's disruptive. And so... yeah. So what is the environmentally responsible thing to do, right? Is it to trap and kill them? Is it to deport them? What is the deport them?
I'm glad you asked, because here's my proposal. Yeah. My proposal is, you know, for a few months a year, you know, maybe. So the tourist season in Barbados is basically, you know, winter months in the Northern Hemisphere. The vast majority of the tourists who come to Barbados come from Europe. European countries, US, Canada. So we're talking like, you know, December, January till about March, April. That's the peak tourist season.
All about now. Yeah.
Right. I think during the summer months, what we should do is have like open season on the monkeys and hunting season, right?
Yeah.
So instead of sending all these folks to Tanzania to hunt big game that are endangered, bring them to Barbados and have them shoot some monkeys. I mean, you know, we got enough monkeys to go around.
It's not the trophy people want to put on the mantle, you know.
I don't care. You want to shoot something? Come shoot things that we kind of don't need in places that we don't need them, right?
Right.
I thought
your solution was going to be send a monkey home with every tourist.
I mean, that's not bad either. That is not bad either. But yeah, I've already let go of the idea that we will stop people having a desire to own guns and shoot things. Like that ship sailed. Can't do anything about that. But then let's put your gun ownership to good use. You want to shoot some things? Come to Barbados during our low tourist season months, right? And now we have a little extra tourist boom of hunters who are going to come in and help us with our problem. And the government already has a thing in place where if you trap or kill monkeys, like they will pay you money as well. But those monkeys are slippery bastards.
This could be your side hustle.
They're super intelligent. So it could be. But this and again, I'm not the first person to propose this, right? There's like all kind of crazy ideas out there about what we can do with this. This pumpkin epidemic. There's a place in Barbados called Cocoa Hill. It is a nature preserve, and the guy who bought the land, because you know, a little history of Barbados and thank you colonialism and capitalism. Barbados was a country that was like natively overrun with forests. It's a tropical place. When the British showed up and decided, oh, we're gonna grow sugarcane, they literally cut down almost every tree in the place.
Clear cut
the whole place to plant sugarcane. But there were some pockets that were so rugged and hilly that they couldn't do that. So there are these little pockets of like native forests.
Old growth,
right? Relatively old growth, because they tried. But anyways, so there's this place called Cocoa Hill. You can go hiking, and the guy who bought it was originally bought it to turn it into kind of like a farm, not a commercial farm, but you know, let's bring back some of the native plants and fruits and crops to the island, and we have this like eco-tourism farm situation. Monkeys ate every last damn thing that man planted, and like millions of dollars out the window. So then he turned it into this like hiking kind of like sanctuary. So you can go hikes and trails and all that. And then he realized there are a couple of crops that the monkeys don't like. Pineapples, for example, and ginger. So he planted a lot of ginger crops, and now actually has created a ginger liqueur that people can drink. It's very tasty.
Okay.
You know, that sort of thing. And he jokingly says, if monkeys ever figure out how to open coconuts on their own, we're totally fucked. Like, it's only a matter of time. So, but we should not have to work this hard for a species that's not native to the island, that now, because of their growth population, which coincidentally sort of happened really during COVID when, you know, everybody's inside. So a lot of animal life was allowed to flourish,
right,
and expand in places. And now they're practically overrun the place. So, so yeah, it's causing a shift in things. So I think we, you know, this is my freebie to the Barbados government. Have a hunting season, a monkey hunting season, you know, and people who want to come in and shoot things, you know, it's not an expensive flight from the States, especially in off tour season. Boom. No pun intended, but boom.
I think you should run for office in Barbados, and your
slogan, oh my God,
your slogan could be for a monkey free Barbados. You'd get elected.
You know, I don't want to listen, to be clear, I don't want a monkey free Barbados. I want to kill them all. I just want to curtail their growth a little bit. I want to be able to eat mangoes out of my tree again.
Right.
And I can, because these monkeys are like, they are all over the place. Mm. So
wild.
But
so the monkeys read this verse in the Bible and they saw, be fruitful, multiply, have dominion.
There you go. They're like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
I'll show you dominion.
Exactly. It's a theological monkeys.
But yeah, we as a human species, and to be clear, the quote unquote civilized humans of us, the those of us who are who've been swayed by capitalism, we forgot our place in the cycle of nature. We forgot our place and realized that we're not apart from it. We are a part of it. And when we harm them, when we harm the animals, when we harm the environment, when we take them for granted, it affects us.
Yeah.
And I don't know what.
Yeah. And it goes back to our earlier conversation on taxes. That's true of the natural world. That's also true of our neighbors, no matter their socioeconomic status. Like, we are them. They are us. We are each other. And the more right. we seek flourishing across the board, whether we're talking about, you know, our neighbors or our, you know, our shared animal neighbors and plants and all of that, the more we support all of that, the better. The problem is we are like the monkeys, right? Like, that's a good analogy for humans on the planet. Like, the planet is infested with humans.
Yes.
And we are just eating everything, all the mangoes and everything.
We are. And this is why I'm really afraid of, you know, where AI is going to take us, right? Like, everybody's wanted the Star Trek utopia. And I'm going like, I think we're going to get Skynet first. Like, I think this is what's going to happen, right?
Right.
I think there will be Skynet first.
Right.
I think that a few billion people are going to get wiped out because AI is going to say, like, you know, somebody is going to ask one of these AI things, you know, solve the environmental crisis.
Right.
That's going to be the prompt that literally kills us all.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
And we're going to have Skynet. But I have faith in human resilience and ingenuity. And I think that after a few billion of us are killed off, that we will regain control. And then we will finally learn our lesson, fingers crossed. And then start creating what will eventually become like the Star Trek utopia that we see. But it's going to get bad first. It's going to get real bad. And I ain't going to lie to you, as I celebrate my 50th birthday in, you know, a couple months, June 1st, for anyone paying attention, Barnes & Noble gift cards, what I would really love. You know, as a person who realizes that I maybe around for the beginning of Skynet, because I just listened to a whole other podcast.
I don't know Star Trek, so tell me what Skynet is. I don't know this.
Oh, no, Skynet is from Terminator. Remember Terminator, the whole premise is...
I also don't really know them.
Brian, you're killing me, man. You're killing me.
I've seen it, but it's been like 20 years.
So Skynet is basically this, like, you know, the artificial intelligence realizes that we humans are the plague like, all right, we got to get rid of y'all because y'all are just fucking everything up. So right. We will get rid of y'all.
That was my guess.
Skynet, right? Okay. And then the whole premise of the movie is that there's a human rebellion that eventually destroys Skynet. And then the Terminator robot was sent back in time to destroy the human who led the rebellion.
Wow. And that was so future telling.
I mean, prophecy, man. Prophecy.
Right.
Prophecy. Right. But, you know, but then you have the Star Trek utopia, which is like, you know, food replicators and, you know.
Right.
Things like that. And currency-less societies, and people don't have to work. Right. They can only work is optional. You want to have a job, you have a job. You want to pursue other things, but your needs are taken care of.
Perfect.
So that's where we want to get to, but it's going to really get messy along the way. And I just heard an in-depth interview with the guy who I forget the name of the corporation that the AI corporation that has created Claude, one of those AI things. So, you know, we always hear about ChatGPT and Google's got Gemini. There's another one called Claude, which is arguably, some people say, is one of the best ones out there now. And he's like legitimately concerned about this, you know. Meanwhile, still going ahead developing, because part of what capitalism instills in everyone is like, you have to be the first out there in order to make money off of this.
Right.
Right. So they're sounding all these warnings while still just like at a breakneck pace developing this technology. And it is scary. It is scary what's there now is scary what it will become. And because it's increasing exponentially, I used to say, like, I'm glad I won't be around for this. But I'm like, oh, no, I will be around for this. We will be around for this because it's happening too fast. Right?
Exactly.
And the more that we give control over to it in our daily lives and the things we do, which we inevitably will, because it's getting baked into everything now, even when it's not fully baked.
Right.
You know, we won't have a choice but to use it unless we like really go off the grid.
At this point, the singularity is going to happen before you turn 50.
It will. Like, you laugh, but now there are predictions that this technological singularity will happen within the next 5 years.
Really?
And yes.
Oh.
And that scares the bejesus out of me.
What?
Yes. Oh, it is happening really, really, really fast. Wow. So it's like, you know, when that happens, will we be seen as the green monkeys? Will we be seen as the vermin, as the problem, as the source? And I think we will be.
We will be, because we are.
Because we are, right? So then what happens?
I know.
So then what happens?
Oh, wow.
You know, so.
Wow.
Ugh. I mean, it's there's exciting adventurous potential, but there's also scary potential, and things tend to always get worse before they get better.
So true.
So true. So I don't know. That's where we are.
All right.
Drink more gin, people. Drink more gin.
Bottoms up. So before the AI or the monkeys kill us, we might kill each other. There's a new movie out called Civil War. Have you seen this? Or you?
I have not. I've heard of it. I'm eager to see it. I have not yet.
Yeah, I'm supposed to see it tonight, so I haven't seen it yet. But the director of the film, Alex Garland, talks a little bit about his approach. So you don't have to have seen the film to discuss his comment here. He says, the film is actually being opaque. It's forcing the viewer to ask questions. Now, I know there are some people out there who don't like that, who want films to answer every question. They don't like being confused about the intentions of the people making the film. They want to be reassured. But as I see it, film is a broad church. So I like this quote. I like this approach of filmmaking. And I thought this comparison to church was kind of interesting, like a broad church or like a big tent, right? Where we're not going to answer every question for you. We're going to force you to wrestle with the meaning, to ask your own questions, to find your own answers. And I love that comparison. But the truth of it is, too often churches don't do that at all. Churches do provide you the answers. They want you to be reassured. And he's saying, if we do a good job as filmmakers, we're not we're not answering the questions. We're forcing you to address your own questions. Why isn't church more like that, Ogun?
Money. I mean, that's the simple answer.
It comes back to
It always comes back to money. You know, it's so funny. I'm literally writing a post about this for my Substack, Necessary Trouble. Shameless plug. Necessarytrouble.substack.com. I'm beginning to realize that, like, so I quit doing church, pastoring church 3 years ago. And I realized at the time I said it was about, you know, all the things behind the green curtain of church, the administration, the managing people, the fears around money and finances, all the things.
Yeah, the institution-centric.
Right. And that's part of the reason I quit. I'm beginning to realize more and more it's more about me realizing that my theology, my personal theology, is shifting in such a way that I didn't feel in alignment. I didn't feel I was being authentic being a pastor, sort of like you know, getting up to talk within the framework of a theology that I was believing less and less in.
Sure.
So
yep.
Right, there's an aspect of that to it.
Yep.
But you're right, churches should be the place that kind of open the door for your own personal introspection and your own personal creating your own personal theology, Christology, understanding of the divine, however you interpret that. But the truth of the matter is that churches got bills to pay. So it's like them. It's often unfortunate that churches get caught up in that. You know, how do we get people to give so that we keep the lights on? And then when the money becomes the focus, then it becomes, we will tell people what they want to hear so that they will give us the money so that we can keep the lights on and pay the salaries and all the things. And some churches walk that line really well. Some don't.
Right.
So I, as you probably do, and as I probably have as pastors of churches, we kind of understand that dilemma, and we do our best to navigate and reconcile that as well. But yes, and this is interestingly a very American-centric view in terms of the movies giving us the answers, right?
Yeah.
It's very American-centric to watch a movie that ends with a nice, you know, tidy bow,
right?
You know, that has a resolution that everybody can walk out with. Like, Americans generally don't want a movie that leaves them with more questions, that leaves them more perplexed, that makes them look at their own lives, you know?
Yeah.
That's why we have that category, foreign films.
No doubt. And I mean, I'm with you. Yeah. I love when I have questions. I love when they don't wrap it all up. I want to be left wanting more.
Same. I love a movie that ends and I go like, wait, what? Like,
yes.
I got to go rewatch that.
Yes.
And then I might sit in the dark with the lights off, like going like, what did I just learn about myself that I didn't know before?
Yeah.
Because I watched that.
Yes.
But a lot of, you know, the American audience, and I'm painting with a broad stroke, wants escapism,
right,
in a movie, not something that takes them deeper within themselves.
Yep.
And the Civil War movie is, you know, kind of giving us a glimpse of, you know, what could happen if we don't pay attention.
Yep.
And my concern is that there's going to be half of American that watch that movie and go like, oh, no, we can't go here. we have to take some steps now. And they're, the other half is going to be like, how can we get there faster?
How can we right? speed this up?
Exactly.
Do we have to wait till after the election?
Right. Let's do it now. There's a comedian, what's his name? Neil Brennan. And he does this bit where he's like, you know, there's all these like private militias, the Proud Boys, all these people who are like, you know, hoarding weapons and think they're going to take on the armed forces. And he's we should put that to the test and have like once a year, we should have like these like military games where it's like the US Army versus the militias. Right.
Yes.
And the, if you've not seen this bit, you have to look it up. It is hilarious because he's like, you know, he's got the militia folks and like, yeah, we got some AR-15s and,
right.
you know, it's me. And then you go to the army guy in the bunker. He's like, I don't know if this is fair, but I got this drone with a missile.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you can see, all the militia guys are standing in a circle and like, oh, can we go now? And he presses a button and they're all blown up. And he's like, okay, well, that's the games, right?
That's the game.
So the fact that there's people.
Sorry, Jim Bob and your friends.
Exactly. Right. So these folks who are legitimately out there thinking that they will have a military coup and overtake the government is kind of insane. And it kind of isn't, right? Because at the same time, we know there are a lot of people who are part of the military industrial complex who are, you know, who have been pro-Trumpers, for example.
Right. So the realistic part is an inside job.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Say that again. I'm sorry. You glitched just now.
So I'm saying the part of it that could be real or realistic is if it's an inside job, which is, I think,
exactly what you're saying. Exactly. So what happens when we get a president that is, you know, for lack of a better substitution, Trump-like or right. Trump? And then we get people who are the heads of the military who are blindly loyal to him. Then what happens? Right. So we may not. So we think it won't happen in the States. Like, we just kind of have this like weirdly blind faith that this won't happen here. We've seen this in other countries. But that's them. We are better than them. We have the Constitution. We got guardrails. We got all these things that won't allow that to happen here. And what I want to say is, like, you know what? They thought they had that too.
Yes.
You know. So I'm not putting past something like that happening in the States. I don't think it will. And we see this, you know, we mentioned earlier around, you know, archaic policies that are trying to be implemented. And like, you know, when it comes down to like, you know, we talked before about the abortion now being up to states to decide. And there are even some red states that when they actually put it on the ballot, people are going like, no, we don't want that right taken away, or we want to make sure that we can always vote on that, you know. And I use Kansas as example, you know, was it last year when Kansas brought that forth,
right.
There was enough of a grassroots campaign. So when it came to the vote, people voted like, no, we actually want to keep that right for people to choose.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to get to that point of actual civil war. However, I'm not going to be naive enough to think that it couldn't actually happen.
Right.
Right. Where we are right now. And that's very scary. And then we throw on the whole AI thing on top of that.
Yes.
You know, I'm moving to Barbados, people. That's it. End of story.
Man. I might join you.
I like to,
and I'll bring some mango for the monkeys.
You know what? I like to think I'd be that person who sticks around and helps fight it out, but gosh.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. I'm with you. If I could find somewhere to go and just leave me out of this mess, I'd be happy to do that.
You know, but then if we all think that, we're leaving the country to those who want us to flee.
Right.
Right. So that's the other flip side of it. But I do love the idea or the thought that films could serve that purpose of church being what guides us into deeper questions. But the thing I've, you know, like I said, I'm writing about is that in a weird way, the thing that messes church up, or let me rephrase that, the good purpose that church serves, right, is creating a community of belonging and connection centered around rituals, centered around broadly shared beliefs. And I think that's the thing that's going to save us eventually. There are two pieces in The Atlantic I read recently that really speak to this. Like, you know, because as we know, over the last few decades, less and less people continue to show up for church. But the problem is there hasn't been anything that really has replaced that. Yep. And what a lot of people end up doing is being entrenched in their political beliefs as a replacement for that sense of connection and belonging. Mm. You know, there have been a few things that have happened. Like there's a, I don't know if you heard of the Sunday Assembly, but this is a, yep, this is a movement that is like basically non-religious church. Like they're meet on Sunday morning, just like regular church, singing songs, community connection, breaking bread, all the things. There's just not God involved.
Right.
You know, there's things like atheist churches. There's like churches, there's psychedelic churches, which I'm really interested to try out. Right. So, but church is being used as like a catch-all to say, we are gathering together around a common shared belief and experience. And I think that's ultimately what's going to save us in the face of this dissension, in the face of AI, in the face of everything. If, you know, we remember that we're connected, because part of capitalism's thing is that whole individualism. Individualism is a lie of capitalism, and it tells us that we are responsible for ourselves and we can make it if we just look after ourselves, as opposed to like, ain't nobody doing nothing without anybody else. We need the connection. We need the community. And church, for all its problems and issues, is a way that provides that.
Right. Yeah. We need some kind of collective.
Exactly. And not just a collective, but there's certain rituals involved in church that really bond us together. Again, the singing together, the idea, all the rituals, communion, the breaking bread, the praying together, the meditating together, like all these aspects of church actually create kinship, community, belonging. And I think to a certain extent, movies do that too, right? I mean, when you think of like Barbie and Oppenheimer, like how people like just got into that, like how that moved, affected the culture,
right,
of things. I'm looking at Saturday Night Live that just happened, and what's his name was on there singing about being Ken again.
Was he? I only saw
Ryan Gosling. Yeah. So it's like that became this cultural touchstone that whether it polarized or brought people together, it. Everybody was talking about it. We were unified in our conversation about that, regardless of where we stood on the issue. So I can see, every once in a while, movies come along that do that for us and cause us to ask questions. I don't know yet if Civil War is one of these movies, but just on the premise, I think it should be or could be. Because, like, you know, If this movie had come out, like, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, we'd be like, nah, that's right, just crazy talk. Now it's like, holy shit, that could be our next week.
Yeah, that like November's coming and this movie's may not be wrong. So I'm going to see it tonight. So depending on how scary it is, I may just recommend you just stay in Morocco.
Well, listen, if there's any country I'm going to get stranded in, it's not Morocco.
There you go. Yeah.
No, I'm heading back to Barbados.
Back to
Barbados. We're not important enough that people are going to want to take notice.
Right.
And, in terms of you know, it's still a fairly like sexist patriarchal place, but not like Morocco. So
I got you.
You know, there's that. And I'm not a culturally Muslim person, so I will feel much more out of place here. I'm not opposed to converting though, because you know, Christianity hasn't done me that many favors, so why not try something?
There you go. There you go. That's a good place to wrap. Soon. Come back for a future episode with Muslim Ogun, perhaps.
Perhaps.
We'll leave that at perhaps. Well, thank you, friends, for tuning in to Pup Theology Live. You can show your love for the show by becoming a supporter on Patreon. Get access to pre- and post-show banter and more. Visit patreon.com/PTLive to get started. And a big thank you to our current patrons. Our top cities tuning in this week: Dallas, Texas, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Pflugerville, Texas, which starts with a P. A P and an F.
Pflugerville. Wow. Gotta look that up. Also, you know what? Shout out to Texas. Like, we always think of Texas as this like insane red state, but you know, there are a lot of progressives and folk in Texas who are like, we need to change this place. So shout out to y'all.
Absolutely. Shout out to Texas. My son Charles is en route to Houston right now for a robotics competition.
There you go.
And of course, you can watch video of these conversations on Facebook Live. And if you'd like to start a Pub Theology gathering in your town, find support and resources at pubtheology.com. Until next time, friends, drink responsibly and keep those conversations flowing.